and welcome to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, broadcasting from the Sanctuary for Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people, known today as the Stockbridge Muncie community. I'm Kalen McPherson.
And I'm Jacob Austin. Today on the Hudson Mohawk Magazine, we begin with Mark Dunley speaking with Albany County Legislator Dustin Reedy about his proposed gun legislation bill. Then, roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry headed to the West Capitol Park to hear from speakers at the March for Our Lives to End Gun Violence. Later on, we get introduced to Ellie Irons, our new Nature Lab community science educator and lab manager. After that, we speak with Leanne L. Arian, executive director of Coalition of Civil Freedoms, one of the co-sponsors of the film screening of Witness, the documentary screening this Friday. Finally, we get some insight into the high school experience. But first, here are the headlines.
The Lake George Park Commission will have to wait to carry out its planned use of a chemical herbicide on Lake George after Warren County judge on Monday halted the plan. The judge ruled that state officials did not present an argument to support an urgent need to apply herbicide this summer, and if it causes the harm the plaintiffs contended, it will be irreversible.
The Rensselaer County Executive is proposing to use $26 million in its accumulated budget surplus to improve county facilities, expand important county services, and broaden for the public to county government. It includes expanded road paving and replacement of the country's 5 senior centers.
In a 5-2 decision, the New York's top courts on Tuesday rejected an effort to free Happy the elephant from the Bronx Zoo, ruling that she does not meet the definition of a person who is being illegally confined.
The outline of the bipartisan United States Senate agreement to rein in gun violence has no game-changing steps, banning the deadliest firearms. It would propose measuring provisions, making it harder for some young gun buyers or people considering threatening to have weapons. And there are efforts to address mental health and school safety concerns. Public demands for stronger gun measures have increased following the recent upsurge in mass killings, including in Buffalo and Texas. That's it for the headlines.
We just had our engineer pop in there for a second. And for those just tuning in, you're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. Like what you hear, find these stories and more at mediasanctuary.org/stories.
To learn how you could contribute, go to mediasanctuary.org or email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org or call 518-272-2390.
Moving right along to our first segment, Albany County Legislator Dustin Reedy has proposed a county law to require warning signs to be displayed at all firearm dealers, indicating the increased risk of violence that is associated with firearms, as well as contact info for the Albany County Mobile Crisis Team and the National Suicide Hotline. Reedy discusses his proposal with Mark Dunley of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
We're joined by Albany County Legislator Dustin Reedy, who has recently introduced some legislation in Albany County in order to deal with the issue of gun violence. He calls it the Albany County Commitment to Ensure a Safe Society or Access. So, Dustin, can you explain, you know, what is this bill about?
Well, thanks for having me on, Mark. I appreciate it. But what this bill is about is doing everything we can at every level of government to stem the horrific tide of gun violence in this country. Like many, if not all of us, you know, I'm horrified and haunted by the mass shootings in Buffalo, followed by Uvalde, Texas, and all the lives that were lost in those mass shootings. But you know, the terror and the problem of gun violence is pervasive and it's constant. In America, gun violence is the number one source of, is the number one killer for children over the age of one here. We're the only developed nation in the world where gun violence is so prevalent, so deadly, and so constant. I wanted to find a way to do anything that I could here at the county level here in Albany County. And Local Law F, the access law, it's a simple, straightforward thing we can do at the county level to help end and prevent gun violence. So what the law will do is it will require any purveyor of weapons and firearms to prominently display a warning sign of the risks that are involved of firearm ownership. It will also display the contact numbers for the mobile crisis team here in Albany County and the National Suicide Hotline. So this is a step in education, in raising awareness. And again, it's a simple step we could take at the county level. I'm hoping and I'm confident this won't be the only step we take here in Albany County, but I'm very proud to make this the first step that we're taking.
Now, I did a little Google search after, you know, read your press release, and I did notice that apparently the state of New York has recently passed a law that's required such notices also as well, that you got to basically keep your, you know, your guns locked up. But how does one deal with the issue that, you know, this might impact upon the responsible person buying a gun, but how about those irresponsible people buying the guns that tend to be the ones who cause the problems, or of course the guns being sold in the black market?
Well, you know, again, looking at the county level, you know, there are certain things that at the state and federal level can be much more impactful on gun violence, especially in what you're talking about, Mark. Raising the age of owning assault rifles, you know, lowering and banning high capacity magazines, you know, strengthening our background checks and strengthening red flag laws. I don't believe we can do those at the county level. So there's certainly some there are things at the state and federal level that we need to do. I think the steps the governor signed into law this week are certainly positive. I know the House passed a comprehensive gun safety package last week, and we'll see, like many things, what happens to it in the Senate. Although even in the Senate, you know, seems like there's a framework for, you know, some positive steps on gun violence prevention. But the fact on the pervasiveness of gun violence, you know, much of that has to do with accidents. And a lot of it has to do, you know, with lives that are lost, you know, through suicide. You know, one, I spoke to a few prevention advocates about this bill. And in fact, this bill is modeled after Westchester County, which passed a similar law in May. When I was searching for what we could do here in Albany County, I came across this on the Everytown for Gun Safety website and spoke to an activist there who just blew me away with the statistic that 90% of suicides that are attempted are successful when they're done with firearms, and 90% of suicides that are attempted are not successful otherwise. Couple this with the fact that you know, when individuals you know, fail at attempts at suicide, they are very, very unlikely to attempt it again. You know, raising awareness about the dangers here, providing some contact information for the mobile crisis team locally and the National Suicide Hotline. I think these may be small steps, on raising awareness and promoting more responsibility and more access and awareness on the dangers here, Mark. But you know, if this local law saves one life through that contact information or through a reminder to someone who's picking up a gun or in a gun store to put their gun lock on their gun, to store their firearms properly, then this law will be successful. And so, again, I know at the county level, you know, our powers may be limited compared to the other levels of government. I just think it's important that we, you know, we do everything we can here on this issue.
You know, I do remember when I ran for Congress back in 1982, the big gun debate at that point was whether or not to ban handguns, which we did somewhat with the Brady law, but then they, I guess the Supreme Court threw that out. But it was interesting to note that after Buffalo, the Canadian prime minister came out and not only stopped the sale or proposed stopping the sale of handguns in Canada, but also seeks to prohibit the sale of 1,500 different types of military assault weapons. Have you run into any opposition at the local level to the legislation that you're proposing from any of the gun rights advocates?
Well, we have, you know, we just introduced this bill this week. It will go to our public safety and our law committees, and then it will come to a public hearing over the next few weeks. I've only gotten support from talking to folks about this legislation before bringing it to the county ledge. Every one of my Democratic colleagues have signed on as a co-sponsor to this bill. You know, I'm hopeful that we'll get some bipartisan support as well. I'm certainly willing to work with all of our legislators through the committee process, you know, before bringing this bill to the floor. I haven't gotten any opposition yet. I won't be surprised if some opposition comes, Mark, but the reception so far has been fantastic on this. I was at the March for Our Lives rally in March on Saturday here in Albany. And, you know, I was amazed to see this event organized by high school students here in the Capital District. And, you know, they had a very straightforward, honest message and a simple message I think we're called to heed here. You know, their lives are on the line. We cannot be numb to this bloodshed. And, you know, these students that are, you know, have been leading the fight here over the last few years, you know, they're forced to go through live shooter drills in schools. And, you know, I know you were fighting on gun violence prevention in the early 80s, and this has been a longstanding issue. But I don't think you or I don't think anyone on the county legislature, you know, none of us had to think about or worry about, you know, someone storming into a school with body armor and an AR-15 that can just mow people down and is literally designed to do nothing else but that.
I'm talking to Dustin Reedy of the Albany County Legislature, and this has been Mark Dunley for the Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
That was a story on proposed legislation around gun safety. Next, we stay on this topic to hear from everyday citizens.
Last Saturday, Hudson Mohawk Magazine roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry attended one of the nation-wide's March for Our Lives to End Gun Violence. The Capital District March started at Albany West Capitol Park and led by various labor and community groups.
Willie Terry, the roaming labor correspondent for the Hudson Mohawk Network. Roaming the Capitol where they are having a march to end gun violence. Big crowd, a lot of teachers and students. Representative Gatto, who was appointed to be the lieutenant governor, is here and he's leading the march. And also the mayor of Albany. And I'm just gonna try to get a statement. And it's Willie Terry, and I have as my guest a member of the of NYSA, the New York State Teachers Union. And your name is?
Melinda Person.
Oh, okay. How you doing, Melinda?
Great, thanks.
So, Melinda, tell me some, give me your thoughts on the march today. What are you thinking? Why is it important that we march?
Today was an important day because we put our voices out saying enough is enough, that it is time for our senators in Washington to move on common sense gun reform legislation. It doesn't matter if you're a Republican or a Democrat. This is a human issue, and our communities and our children are at stake.
Okay. And Melinda, so you're in labor, you said, right? And just what is your position in labor?
I'm the executive director of New York State United Teachers.
Oh, okay. And why is it important that labor get involved in this issue?
Well, labor is everywhere, right? In New York State especially. But we represent 675,000 teachers, paraprofessionals in schools, nurses, doctors, professors around New York State. And we want workplaces that are safe. We live in communities that we are demanding that they're safe. So this is most definitely a labor issue. It's in particular an issue for educators, I believe, because our workplaces have been the targets of some of these shootings. But we are standing up and saying now is the time. We're not going to wait any longer. These laws must get passed.
Right. You know, I just talked to the mayor of Albany, and I asked her the question about that Texas incident and the impact that it, psychological impact that it may have on kids. Are y'all hearing any of that?
Most definitely. I can speak as a parent of, I have two third graders and a kindergartner, similar age of the victims in Uvalde. And you know what? I actually have not talked that much about it to my kids because I want school to be a safe place for them. I don't want them to be afraid. And I, as a parent, shouldn't have to worry when I put my kids on the school bus every morning that they might not come home today. And it's not a, this is not a normal thing for us to feel this way. America, United States, is a unique nation in terms of how we experience and have experienced all of this gun violence. And there are common sense things we can do to change it. And we are, we believe that this time it's going to be different, that this isn't going to be another march and then we wait until the next one. This time we're not stopping until we win.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you.
Yeah.
All right.
You're welcome. Yeah. Very nice to meet you.
And I'm here with my guest, Mayor of Albany, Kathy Sheehan. And how you doing, Mayor?
I'm doing all right. I'm sorry that we have to be here because it seems like the majority of the people in this country should be listened to and Congress should be acting, but we're here to tell them we expect them to act.
And Mayor, so what are your thoughts on the march today?
Well, I think it's a great turnout on a beautiful Saturday afternoon to have so many people come out. We have nurses and teachers, students, parents coming out and saying we need to protect our kids. Our children are more important than the insanity around how easy it is to get a gun in this country. That's not what the Second Amendment intended. It's not, you know, what our country needs, and we have to come together. We are the majority. The majority of people want universal background checks. The majority of the people don't want people to be able to own weapons of war. The majority of people want there to be a way to take a gun away from a person who is experiencing some sort of, whether it's domestic violence or acting in ways that could endanger other people. These are just common sense guardrails that keep us safe, and that's what we're here to demand.
And Mayor, I know this is a nationwide problem, but and you're Mayor of Albany, so just tell me, what impact has gun violence had on Albany?
Well, I mean, gun violence is still at an epidemic rate across this country, and Albany has not been spared. And we are seeing guns in our community in huge numbers that are coming here from states where you can get a gun without a background check, where they haven't closed the gun show loopholes. Governor Hochul signed legislation that is going to help New Yorkers to be safer, but we need action at the federal level because people are coming into this community and we are seeing just a proliferation of guns that we've never seen before. We took 200 guns off the street last year, and we're already well over almost 50% ahead of where we were last year. So these guns are making their way into our community, and that's why we need national action.
And I agree with what you said, that it needs to be something on a federal level. But how important it is that the community also take action?
Well, I have to commend people in the community who are speaking up. People in our community understand that guns are not that gun violence is unacceptable in our communities, and that we deserve to be safe. And so many of the guns that we've taken off the street because a community member told the police that somebody had a gun, and that is saving lives. So I first want to thank the community for being willing to recognize there's got to be a line, right? We need to have a hard line against using guns to solve petty disputes and having guns in our community and on our streets. So I want to commend the community for helping the police. I also want to commend the police for working really hard to focus on guns and gun violence. And we have to continue to support that to get guns off the street, because every time we lose somebody to gun violence, it's not just that person that we've lost. It's their family that's traumatized, their friends, their neighbors. And the impact of it lasts for decades. It lasts people's lifetimes. You can't get that child back that you lost to gun violence. And so we need to stand together and recognize that this is where we need to draw the line as a community. We've got to put an end to gun violence. We can't. And we've also got to look at the demand side. Why is somebody choosing to pick up a gun? We have too many people who are engaging in reckless behavior because they think that's how they're supposed to act. And we've got to send a message that that's not who we are in Albany. That's not our culture. That's not what we want in our neighborhoods. And so there is a role for every resident of the city to play in taking back our community from these guns and saying no, no. And so we've got to figure out other ways to solve our disputes. We've got to figure out other ways to be in community together that doesn't involve everybody getting a gun.
Now, one of the things that people in the community talk about is that the Constitution gives me the right to have a gun. You know, so how do you deal with people who
right. So I'm not saying that you don't have a right to own a gun. What we're saying is that right to own a gun comes with responsibility. You are taking ownership of a weapon that has the ability to kill. So in the city of Albany, you have to have a safe place to store that gun, and you have to keep it stored and out of the reach of children. You have to keep a lock on that gun so that it cannot fire accidentally. These are common sense rules that are in place to keep people safe. You have to have a background check to make sure that you can legally own a gun, because we lose rights when we engage in certain behaviors, and we want to ensure that we have responsible gun ownership. So those are the common sense rules of the road that exist here in New York, and we have some of the lowest gun deaths per capita of any state in the country. We rank, I believe, 47th. So notwithstanding the gun violence that we see, we are better off than many other places. So we need those common sense rules of the road to apply across the country. Because if they don't apply across the country, we have borders that people can cross very easily, and they can buy guns illegally in another state, in Pennsylvania, in Florida, in Alabama, in Georgia, and they can bring those guns into our community. We need to put a stop to that.
The incident in Texas, right? You know, the kids getting killed, I know that had a dramatic effect or impact on kids all across the country. And what are some ways that the school system in Albany is kind of dealing with that?
Well, you know, I think that our school board and our school administration, they need to step up and identify ways to address those issues and that trauma, and I think that they are. I think from the standpoint of coming together as a community. Just the fact that we had hundreds of teachers and students marching here today is a show of support. I also want to say it causes trauma for our Black and Brown community to see what happened in Buffalo, where people, just because of the color of their skin, were targeted. That's trauma. So we have to say that out loud. We have to say that out loud, that we have to be there for one another, and we have to say, this is traumatic, and you should be feeling a certain way about it, and it's okay. Don't isolate, push it away. We've got to talk about it and acknowledge it.
Thank you, Mayor.
Roaming labor correspondent Willie Terry spoke to New York State United Teachers Executive Director Melinda Person and Albany Mayor Kathy Sheehan at the March Against Gun Violence.
For those just tuning in, I'm Kaelin McPherson.
And I'm Jacob Bosden. You're listening to the Hudson Mohawk Magazine on the Hudson Mohawk Radio Network on WOOCLP 105.3 FM Troy, WOOSLP 98.9 FM Schenectady, WOOALP 106.9 FM Albany, WOOGLP 92.7 FM Troy, and WCAALP 107.3 FM Albany. This program comes from the Sanctuary of Independent Media in Troy, New York, on the unceded homelands of the Mohican people known as the Stockbridge-Munsee community.
This program covers stories of social and environmental justice produced by the community for the community and is supported by independent donations. To learn more about this program and how to support the Sanctuary for Independent Media, visit us online at mediasanctuary.org.
Nature Lab has a new addition to help with the programming and lab management. Let's introduce you to Ellie Irons.
Hi, I'm Ellie Irons, and I am the community science educator and lab manager at Nature Lab.
Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine, Ellie Irons. You are no stranger to this or the sanctuary. You're now part of our staff, recently joined us. And for those listeners who may not recognize your name, can you tell us about some of the work that you've done with the sanctuary and on your own?
Sure, yeah. So I moved to Troy in 2017 to do the electronic arts program at RPI and immediately started working at the sanctuary as a volunteer and as an educator. So in that capacity, I started running Nature Lab open hours back when the building across the street housed Nature Lab. And I did Uptown Summer mentorship at one point. And I also have been running the Lawn Redisturbance Laboratory, which is an art and ecology project that's right next door to Collard City Growers. I'm an artist with a strong interest in urban ecology and field work. So I do my work out in the public on the street as much as possible.
So now you are the community science educator and land manager. What does that mean? What are you doing?
It means a variety of things. So Nature Lab exists as a community science lab in one way. That's the first floor of the new blue building that opened up just south of Collard City Growers. And in that capacity, I get to work on the various initiatives that are happening in the lab and kind of help make sure they run smoothly. So we've got the Water Justice Lab, we've got our soils, we've got the beginnings of some air quality monitoring, and I just make sure that folks can get into the lab when they need to, that they have what they need, and work with folks who need help in that way. And then the community science educator kind of also takes me outside of the lab and onto the grounds of the sanctuary's environmental campus. So I work at Collard City Growers, and I work to kind of try to find ways to bridge inside and outside from the, you know, the community science lab out into the gardens and think about how we can make the whole kind of nature lab container include both of those pieces.
Right, the living, learning laboratory. Sometimes the threads between the Nature Lab and People's Health Sanctuary and Collard City Growers can be complex for people. What are some examples of how you thread these connections between the different initiatives?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, I think a really great example is the work we're doing with Abby Kinchy and Kathy High with Our Soil, because that is a soil testing project that aims to get really accessible, cheap soil testing for lead tests into people's hands and does it in the neighborhood. So it's really, it makes a lot of sense to have a lab where people can see the kinds of materials that need to go into making one of these kits. Like, we need to prepare the kits, we actually need a fume hood, right? That's a hood that sucks toxins out of the air and makes sure that you don't breathe anything in. You don't want to breathe in, because even though these are very accessible, low-cost kits, there's one little component that takes hydrochloric acid. So having the ability to do that on the block in North Central Troy, not needing to leave to RPI, being able to demonstrate that to people safely, and then to have us fan out into the neighborhood and actually test the soil, including at places like Collard City Growers and other of our living learning laboratory spaces on the campus, really makes a meaningful connection between the work done in the lab and the work done out on the land. And I think that in even bringing in the People's Health Sanctuary, I mean, that's intimately entangled with people's level of comfort getting the benefits that they deserve to get from urban green spaces that a lot of folks are denied when they don't know if that land is safe or not. So hopefully through this kind of work, we really can tie together the health sanctuary work, the kind of wet lab, the bio lab aspects, and being out in the field.
Water Justice Lab is one way where youth fellows from the community are being brought into the lab. There's also the open hours of Collard City Growers. What are other ways that the community has access to Nature Lab?
Sure. So maybe I'll talk a little bit more about what Water Justice Lab is, because that kind of, I think, is a nice model for getting folks into the lab. It's kind of a civic science project in that these fellows that have been hired, it's in collaboration with Riverkeeper. They actually, when they come, we come one weekend a month, we all go out to the river together and sample some water. And then we get deliveries of water from all up the kind of northern flow of the river. And they get tested right there in the lab by these youth fellows. And they're actually engaged in the sampling, and then they're engaged in the lab process. And then with Collard City Growers, we're opening our gates, as it were, twice a week, Thursday evenings from 5 to 8, and then Friday from 4 to 6 is a kind of family oriented open hours, but open to everyone. And those focus both on stewardship, like the kind of harvesting and care and tending we need to do for the land. So they can be educational opportunities and also really great way to give back to the garden, but also just an invitation for people to come and relax. And you don't have to, you can just bring your kid and hang out in a blanket and soak in some vibes. As far as other ways for folks to get involved in the lab, I think that that's something that it needs to get expanded. We don't have any regular open public hours right now, but that's something that I would love to see happen in the future as we develop more ways for folks to plug in, or just the kinds of things that folks can come in and look at and learn from quickly without having to necessarily, you know, get involved in one of these projects right away, kind of a first step in. So that's something I'm excited to see happen, but isn't active yet. Pretty new to actually having opened the doors and coming out of COVID with what is happening in the lab right now.
Can you talk a little bit more about the land stewardship idea with Collard City Growers? I hear a lot of people expecting a garden to be intensive labor, really having a goal of producing a certain amount of produce. What kind of model is Collard City Growers showcasing?
Yeah, so it's different than a normal community garden. It's also different from a garden that's oriented towards producing annual crops. As you pointed out, you will see some annual crops. You'll see some rows of kale, maybe some tomato plants. These are the kinds of plants that need to be planted and harvested yearly. But the bulk of what you'll see at Collard City, which I really love, is these perennial plants, meaning plants that come back year after year. And we're talking food forest type plants. So we've got peaches ripening. We're just coming out of cherry season. We've got a lot of other like gooseberries, black raspberries. You're going to see throughout the year these plants producing. And they do need to be tended a little bit, right? They do better if we prune them, if we fertilize them, but they're not the kind of crop that needs to be planted and tended to each year. And part of the interest in working that way at College City Growers has to do with the amount of labor that goes in and the amount of food that we get out, and also the balance of creating a biodiverse habitat that's beneficial for humans and non-humans. So humans step into this space and you might not be immediately feeling like, oh, this is just like every other community garden I've been in. I can see the neat rows of corn. I can see the neat rows of herbs. But hopefully you can feel a little bit like this is an active habitat. I see these winding paths with wood chips. I see flowers sprouting out. I see, once you learn a little bit more about what you're looking at, I see medicine and nutrition and food everywhere. And it's not just food for me as a human. It might be food also for some of the insects who so desperately need habitat right now in our cities. And also a really, I think Azare Keahi has done a lot of work around bringing in plants that have a range of relationships to diverse cultures. So a kind of a garden where, depending on where you're from in the world or where you grew up or what kind of cultural associations you have, you might recognize a plant that I wouldn't recognize, that the next person wouldn't recognize, and be like, oh, I do XYZ with that plant. So trying to also create bioculturally diverse green space at Collard City Growers.
And once again, those open hours are Thursdays and Fridays. What are the hours?
Thursdays 5 to 8 and Fridays 4 to 6.
And that is a great place to meet you, Ellie Irons, our new community science educator and lab manager at the Sanctuary. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Sina. Great to chat with you.
That was Sina Bazila Hickey speaking with new Nature Lab community science educator and lab manager Ellie Irons.
This Friday at the Sanctuary for Independent Media, we will have a Be the Media workshop and film screening of Witness with director Masood Huck. To give some context to this film, Sina Bazila Hickey reached out to one of the co-sponsors, Coalition for Civil Freedoms.
Hi, my name is Lena Alarian. I'm the executive director of the Coalition for Civil Freedoms.
Welcome to Hudson Mohawk Magazine. On Friday, we have a film screening of Witness, a documentary film about the Arif Hossein sting case in Albany. And it follows the defendants, Yassin, Arif, and Mohammed Hossein, in their memories of the events leading up to their arrest and subsequent years. Your organization, the Coalition for Civil Freedoms, is one of the co-sponsors of this screening and subsequent panel discussion. Can you tell us about your organization?
Sure. Thank you for having me on. We're an organization that's dedicated to advocating for people we feel were created as political prisoners in the government's war on terror domestically after 9/11. Most of the prisoners that we support are Muslim. They were targeted for their faith, which we feel was criminalized by the government following the Patriot Act. It's passing the deployment of thousands of informants, FBI informants and undercover agents targeting people, targeting mosques, infiltrating communities, infiltrating places of worship, and, you know, just engaging in this fishing expedition of so-called terrorists. And so many of us are impacted by these policies and have come together to try to end them.
The war on terror was started by the government, but what role did media have in perpetuating this idea?
Of course, the role of the media has been exceptionally harmful, not just since 9/11, but even in the 90s. Growing up as a Muslim American in Florida, we've seen a noticeable shift after the end of the Cold War, painting Muslims as this new enemy in the Muslim world at large. My father, who was a political activist and professor in Florida, was targeted by our local newspaper for a decade, where thousands and thousands of articles were written about him, maligning him, smearing him, labeling him a terrorist for his advocacy in support of Palestinian human rights, for his advocacy in support of civil rights of Muslims in this country. And I witnessed it firsthand growing up. There was a really shoddy fake journalist whose work has been discredited, a self-described terrorism expert, Stephen Emerson, who made a documentary in which my father was maligned in it. And that kind of unleashed this decade-long investigation and, you know, two-decade-long criminalization of my father and other Muslim men in the community. So, you know, it isn't just that I've seen it, I've lived it. And I think it's so important that we work to, you know, change the narrative and reshift the narrative to one that presents, you know, these policies accurately, that explains the stories of these people who are often just simply, you know, labeled as criminals or terrorists, but in fact, were victims of these unjust policies.
You mentioned that you primarily work with people who are criminalized for their Muslim faith. How does that scale in demographics? What kind of demographics are you seeing for people who are targeted for their political standing?
What's interesting is that in the last decade, especially, we've seen a rise of Muslim converts, you know, American, Black, White, Latinx converts to Islam of all, you know, backgrounds, who are simply getting to know the faith, who, you know, tend to be a little bit too trusting of this older presenting as Muslim scholar or man or mentor in the community. In one case that I've, you know, learned about, it was a white American woman who was a convert to Islam and who had reached out to an imam that she didn't know. It was actually an informant posing as an imam, exploiting her, you know, trust in them as a spiritual figure, as a mentor, to try to entrap her in a terrorism sting. So it's been really just disheartening to see. I think it's caused a lot of mistrust in the community, people being suspicious of getting to know one another. In another case, the young man, he was a white man convert to Islam. It was the imam at the mosque that introduced him and his group of friends to the informant, thinking that they would have a lot in common. And in fact, the informant was there at the behest of the FBI to fish and find targets that they could entrap in building friendships for years, you know, these really close-knit friendships where they're, you know, staying at each other's homes and, you know, attending weddings and birthdays and, you know, intimate gatherings. But in fact, they're just trying to, you know, ensnare the person in a fake criminal act. So you'd be surprised. Of course, we have a lot of Black Americans, you know, who, of course, are targeted disproportionately by the criminal legal system, people who, for economic reasons, are ensnared in these plots, offered financial incentives. We have a lot of people who suffer from mental health issues, who have been diagnosed for years, and that still doesn't protect them from these harsh sentences or inspire any sort of leniency. The government acknowledges that these people suffer from mental health issues, and they still go after them.
Coalition for Civil Freedoms was founded by political prisoners for political prisoners. You told us earlier that about your own personal story with your father being targeted in Florida for his advocacy of civil rights for Muslims. How does this personal relationship to the criminalization of political beliefs reinforce what your organization is doing?
I think the biggest lesson is to not be afraid to speak out. I think my personal experiences have taught me that, you know, silence doesn't protect you. My father was an outspoken advocate. He was targeted, unfortunately. But, you know, I think his experience in the prisons, in the federal prison system, you know, being kept in solitary confinement for 42 straight months at one point, being the only pre-trial detainee. I mean, he still hasn't even had his day in court, and he was kept in the maximum security unit of a federal prison. All of these things actually inspired him later on to start the Coalition for Civil Freedoms, because he saw the injustice of our criminal legal system, the injustices of the prison system, the types of people that, you know, are harshly, you know, sentenced or harshly treated, and especially demographics. I mean, those who are, you know, economically disadvantaged, educationally, who, you know, suffer from all sorts of vulnerabilities in this country. But specifically with his case, I mean, I think we as a family felt so unsupported. We were largely abandoned by our community, unlike Albany, where there was support for the defendants, where people kind of came out. We use the example in Albany almost as a model for how we wish other communities would act in the face of these injustices, because they shut down the abuses by the FBI going forward. They never had another entrapment cases. Unfortunately, my father's case, it wasn't an entrapment case. It was just a political targeting case. But since then in Florida, there were a number of entrapment cases that we've seen. We had a great community there of organizers outside of the Muslim community coming out, but still not enough critical mass to shut down these abuses by the government. And so we felt that this issue was underserved. You know, my father certainly did, and he always believes in a strength in numbers. He had organizing experience campaigning to end the use of secret evidence against Muslims in the 1990s. These were immigrants, Muslim men, who were detained for years without being charged with a single crime. They weren't released, they weren't deported, and they weren't able to confront their accusations. So my father lobbied and organized against that until they were able to free the two dozen or so men at the time who were targeted in those policies. But of course, the Patriot Act came after 9/11, and you know, everything was kind of like ramped up to 60 or 120 or whatever. And yeah, his post 9/11 hysteria allowed for these policies to go unchecked. And, you know, it was that Dick Cheney 1% doctrine that even if there's a 1% chance of them being a terrorist, we're going to treat it as 100% certainty. So this created a lot of victims of people who were unfairly targeted by the government and criminalized, and their lives totally destroyed as a result. But there were certain nuances in my father's experiences that only people who have been in the prison system, who have, you know, suffered inside on the inside could tell you, which is, you know, things like making a phone call to family members, the exorbitant costs of, you know, being a prisoner in the federal prison system where it's so exploitative. Families, the financial burden that they carry, having to send money to their loved ones to buy hygiene items, to buy food, to place calls. And so, you know, emotional, psychological, social support for the affected family members. I mean, there's a common saying for anyone who has a loved one locked up that when a loved one is imprisoned, the family member is imprisoned, you know, mentally with them, emotionally. You're constantly thinking about that person, your thoughts are always with them, you're suffering as they are, but in a different way. And so fortunately or unfortunately, but you know, there were just enough people that, you know, we were able to create an organization of impacted families. I mean, an impacted family member said, you know, how sad is it that there are so many victims that there are enough to create a whole conference around it, which is what we've also done for a decade, is we do an annual conference for families of political prisoners where we come together and we try to turn the victimization into empowerment, to try to lobby and advocate for our loved ones, to, you know, learn how to deal with the media, to speak about our cases, our loved ones' cases, to advocate for them, to reclaim the narrative of what happened, and really try to challenge, you know, the negative media coverage that we feel has unfairly presented our loved ones.
So talking about reshifting the narrative and telling stories from your own perspective or from a personal perspective, why is this film, Witness, by director Masoud Haq, important in that reshifting of the narrative?
Yeah, that's a really important question. I think the story of Yasin Arif and Hamad Hussein doesn't end at their conviction. I mean, they are, in the eyes of the government, in the media, convicted terrorists, but in the eyes of themselves, their families, and those who understand these policies, who have followed these unjust cases, they were and remain political prisoners and people who are victimized by the government. And so I think this education, this work to correct the policies in the aftermath of 9/11, to create this oral history of what happened from our perspective, is really important and something that I hope we can support as a coalition, as advocates for these prisoners in the years going forward, to show the public the reality of what happened and not simply what's been written about them or what the government has said they were guilty of.
Thank you for joining us, Lina Al-Arian.
Join us this Friday for the screening of Witness with director Masood Hook at 5 p.m. At 5 p.m. is the Be the Media workshop on the struggle to tell your story. And stick around, because at 7 p.m. is the film screening, followed by a panel discussion.
You know what else is coming up this weekend? It's the graduation of Troy High School. And Jacob, you'll be one of those people walking across the stage to get your diploma. How does it feel?
It feels great. Obviously, it's been a very tumultuous high school experience with, COVID and just growing up from, a 15-year-old boy to, where I am now. So I'm excited to culminate the journey with a celebration of my excellence.
Tell us a little bit more of your time in school with COVID.
So I feel like I went through three different stages of it. 10th grade was when, it hit. I remember before we got shut down, we were all like, oh, it's nothing. We were making jokes, oh, maybe one of the students will take one for the team so we get to be at home for the rest of the year. And then it really happened. And then, I don't know, it was just a different time. We didn't have it was our first time really being remote learning. We had a lot of assignments to do, a lot of independent work with a lot of students, try different methods of learning, copying off each other, things like that, but we won't discuss that here. Then there was 11th grade where we did full-on remote learning over Zoom, and that was very different by just the scheduling, because usually I wake up earlier to go to school, maybe 7:30, but school started at 8:35. I wake up at 8:32, So on most days, usually some, yeah. And just, learning through a computer is a lot different than, being in class. And then this year we come back to, I guess, normal learning, but, there's mask on. We have the mask on, mask off thing. You have to wear masks for half the year. Then you take them off. Then there's this thing of people wearing them, people not wearing them, that whole social construct thing. So it's been a very different experience from year to year, so I'm excited that we got through it, and I'm happy for my peers as well.
So in your last year, you interned with us, the Sanctuary for Independent Media, and this program, Hudson Mohawk Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
Why were you interested in working with this radio program, and what was the experience like?
So I was interested in working in with or being an intern in journalism. And then the opportunity to work here, intern here, was presented to me. And I was immediately ready to go because I like learning things and I want to be a journalist for my career. So as soon as the coordinator for the program came up to me, she was like, we have the intern ready for you. We have the internship ready. I was immediately ready. And then me and Sina, we met on the first day. We've been collaborating on a few things. She's been helping me along the way. She is amazing. She keeps this whole thing going. I don't know how, but thank you.
I don't know how she does it either.
I don't know. Amazing.
So what do you want to get out of this internship?
I just want to do two things. I want to become a better journalist. That's asking questions, having conversations. I think just becoming better at having conversations can help me just in my life in general, outside of just being a journalist, but being a human in general. And I also just want to have or take in all the experiences that the media sanctuary, the sanctuary for independent media has to offer. There's a lot of cool things Cena showed me on the tour we did a couple weeks ago. I'm excited to dive in all those things and sort of get involved around here.
Right. Tell stories that can impact our listeners in so many ways.
Yeah.
You know, where are you going from here?
So plan is in January, I'm going to Marist College for communications, sports journalism. That's the plan. Till then, in the summer, I'm going to be interning here, hopefully into the fall and up until I have to go to college. So that's the plan for my immediate future.
We hope that you stay on even further than that and hope college goes well and hope the future brings a lot of interesting opportunities. As a summer intern, will we hear more of you? So the listeners can stay tuned for that. Anything else you'd like to say? Anything you'd like to add? Any information?
Nothing for me specifically. I just like to say I am very, it's very cool what you guys have going on here. From being from the inside, being seeing how this thing is all put together, it's very amazing, very intricate, very cool. I just like how all this is going, and I'm excited to keep working with you guys in the future.
Well, thank you, Jacob, for talking with me today. And he'll be graduating this weekend with Woo-hoo. Troy High School.
Yes, sir. We did it.
And
love you, Mom.
And congratulations. Congratulations. I know how it feels to walk across that stage. I did it many years ago myself. Not many years ago. Anyways, that concludes our show. We hope you enjoyed this episode of the Hudson Mohawk Magazine. I'm Keelan McPherson.
And I'm Jacob Boston.
Our engineer is the amazingly talented Cena Bazilla Hickey. Our content is produced entirely by volunteers. To learn how you can contribute to local stories of social and environmental justice, email us at hmm@mediasanctuary.org. Thank you to all of our volunteers and sanctuary sustainers. Thank you so much to make this show happen. If you're a value independent media, consider a gift of a monthly donation as a sanctuary sustainer by going to mediasanctuary.org. We want to hear from you. How do you experience Hudson Mohawk Magazine? What resonates with you most? What could we do better? Connect with us on our social media page at Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Media Sanctuary. Tune in every weekday at 7 a.m., 9 a.m., and 6 p.m. to hear local news or stream Sanctuary Radio at mediasanctuary.org. Hudson Mohawk Magazine is also available on demand as a podcast or individual stories at mediasanctuary.org. And thank you to all of our producers for tonight and, again, our engineer. Until next time, folks, thanks for tuning in.